Sitting at the Seder in Jerusalem, the young Prince George, the younger son of the king, did not know that his elder brother would pass away and that he would be the future George V. He certainly did not know that in 1917, his reign would extend over the city Jerusalem. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 158, The Princes at the Seder. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In every generation, one is obligated to see oneself as if he had just left Egypt. It is one of the most celebrated passages in the Haggadah. Not only did the Almighty take out our ancestors from there, the passage continues, but also us. What does it mean to see ourselves as if we left Egypt? How can we remember something that did not physically occur to us? This is an obvious question, one which occurred to any number of commentators. The medieval sage that authored the commentary Shibboleth HaLeket refers in explanation back to an earlier passage of the Haggadah, where we say that if God had not taken us out of Egypt, Hare anu uvaneinu uvnei vaneinu mishubadim hayinu lefara b'mitzrayim, then we and our children and our children's children would still be bound to Pharaoh in Egypt. Therefore, Shibboleth HaLeket argues, we can personally speak about experiencing the Exodus because, he writes, Hare anu bichlal kol anisim, she'ilu lo yatzuhein, adayin hayinu avadim lefara b'mitzrayim. We are included in the miracle, because if they had not gone out of Egypt, we would still be slaves. This explanation is understandable, but insufficient. Yes, of course, the original Exodus impacts us. We are its beneficiaries. But what does it mean for us to say that we can see ourselves as if those leaving Egypt were us? The answer, I think, can be found in how the passage begins. Bechol dor vador. In every generation and generation. It would have been sufficient for the Haggadah to say, Bechol dor, in every generation, one is obligated to see oneself, etc. But an extra word is added, Bechol dor vador, in every generation and generation. Why in every generation and generation? The rabbis, I think, are keying us into the essence of intergenerational Jewish memory, which lies in dor vador, generation to generation. The key to Jewish memory, the key to Jewish transmission, is seeing ourselves as part of a larger chain, with every Jewish generation linked to the one before and the one after, and therefore all intimately bound up with each other. Herein lies the uniqueness of the Jewish perspective. The great historian Chaim Yosef Yerushalmi, in his classic book Zachor on the meaning of Jewish memory, notes that while Herodotus in Greece is considered the father of the field of history, nevertheless, quote, neither the Greek historians nor the civilization that nurtured them saw any ultimate or transcendent meaning to history as a whole. Indeed, they never quite arrived at a concept of universal history, of history as a whole. Herodotus wrote with the very human aspiration of, in his own words, preserving from decay the remembrance of what men have done and of preventing the great and wonderful actions of the Greeks and the barbarians from losing their due meed of glory, end quote. But Yerushalmi adds, quote, beyond that, history had no truths to offer, and thus it had no place in Greek religion or philosophy. If Herodotus was the father of history, the father of meaning in history, were the Jews, end quote. In other words, Greek history examines and preserves great feats that occurred in a specific generation in a particular dor, but Jewish memory applies meaning in the link between dor vador, between generation and generation, insisting that we are links in a chain, the memory of each connecting those that have come before with those that will follow. We remember as part of a chain. That is how we too can experience the Exodus. The linking of generations is the key to our memory, but this also means that Jews link themselves in every generation not only to the past, but also to the future, and that looking back, we see connections between past and future. And it's with this in mind that we can ponder with wonder one Seder in 1882 in Jerusalem, considering all that had occurred and reflecting on all in that moment that lies in store for the future of the city. To set up this story, we must ponder all that occurs in the years 1881 and 1882 and how this sets the stage for what will follow. Terrible persecutions in Russia lead to a large aliyah that begins then, a settling of parts of the land of Israel through a movement that becomes known as Chovevei Tzion, the Lovers of Zion, and what comes into being through it are locations such as Rishon LeZion and Petach Tikva. And in Jerusalem, a Jew arrives in 1881 who will have a dramatic impact on the future of the city and the land. His original name is Eliezer Perelman, and he will become known as Eliezer ben Yehuda. Norman Lebrecht, in his book Anxiety and Genius, gives us the moment in a Paris cafe when the central idea defining Eliezer Perlman's life comes to him. Quote, on his first visit to the cafe, biographers can't agree if it was La Pinfon or the Chat Noir. Perlman talks for 2 hours with a man he thinks is called Zundelman, but it might be Edelman. The pair attempt a conversation in biblical Hebrew and fail. That showed me straight away how hard it was to talk Hebrew, how far Hebrew still was from being an adequate expression for the needs of daily life. That afternoon, Perlman coins the first word in modern Hebrew. He needs to say dictionary. He calls it Milon, end quote. Arriving in Jerusalem in 1881, Perlman devotes himself to the resurrection of Hebrew as a language that can be spoken and applied to the modern world, or as Lebrecht further writes of the years that followed, quote, Ben Yehuda composes new words. He takes chashmal, electricity, from a psychedelic vision of the prophet Ezekiel, a word that denotes immediacy and speed. Machine, mechona, revowels, a Latin noun. Motor car is mechonit. Foodstuffs come mostly from the French. Ananas for pineapple and tapuach adama, apple of the earth, from pomme de terre. A Jaffa orange is apple of gold, tapuz for short. Domestic interiors, prosdor or mizderon for corridor, traklin for lobby, are Aramaic. End quote. Meanwhile, it is in Jerusalem in 1882 that two individuals arrive for a tour, Prince Albert and Prince George, sons of King Edward of Britain. Albert is the Prince of Wales, the expected heir, and the prince's tour of a great deal of the world includes a trip to the Holy Land. A description of their journey is published as The Cruise of Her Majesty's Ship Bacchante, 1879 to 1882, compiled from the private journals, letters, and notebooks of Prince Albert Victor and Prince George of Wales, with additions by John F. Dalton. This is the title given the volumes. And from this publication, we learn that while in Jerusalem, the princes amazingly actually attended a Passover Seder of the Sephardic chief rabbi of the sacred city. I will quote several excerpts from the description. And as the published text gives us details from the Seder, it also, in parentheses, references what it deems to be related passages in Jewish scripture and Christian scripture. I give a few selected quotes. We read, quote, in the evening at 6:30, we all went with Sir Charles and Lady Wilson and Dr. Chaplin to the celebration of the Passover at the house of the chief rabbi of the Sephardim, Raphael Meyer Panagil, a venerable old man with a white turban and long cloak trimmed and lined with fur, which he wore over his flowing underdress. He was accompanied by Rabbi Nissim Baruch, nearly as old and venerable as himself. They met us at the door of his house, and we went with them into his dining chamber, where the rest of his family were assembled. It was a long vaulted room, one half of which was raised as a dais about 2 feet above the other. Two supper tables were spread round which the family at once grouped themselves. The old man's wife in festal dress, his sons and their children all sat round the circular table on which was placed a large waiter, 5 feet in diameter, containing the unleavened bread, the charoseth, a kind of thick sauce made of figs, dates, raisins, and vinegar, and said to typify the clay with which their ancestors made bricks in Egypt, the bitter herbs, lettuce, and dye of wild celery, to commemorate the bitterness of the Egyptian bondage, and a plate with a large mutton bone. The supper began by all drinking the first of the 4 cups of wine mixed with water, which are passed round during the evening, and by giving of thanks to God for the fruit of the vine and for the day. Then, after washing his hands, the rabbi took one of the 3 large, flat, round loaves of unleavened bread from the table, and, nursing it as it were in his arms, blessed it. Then he brake it and gave it to them all, and they did all eat, mingling with it mouthfuls of the bitter herbs after dipping them in the sauce. The rabbi then cut off a piece of the loaf and put it away in a napkin for him that should come, that is, the expected Elijah. It was explained that this would be used again later on in the supper, when Elijah does not come instead of the paschal lamb. This last was also represented by the mutton bone on the plate, since the sacrifice in the temple had ceased. End quote. The book further tells us that, quote, we were much impressed by the complete domesticity of the feast, end quote, and that, quote, when we rose to leave, the chief rabbi chanted a prayer, invoking blessings on the Queen of England, on the Prince and Princess of Wales, and every member of the family. The whole ceremony had lasted 2 hours. As we walked home through the streets of the Jewish quarter, we heard other families celebrating the Passover with closed doors, end quote. The scene provides us with a fascinating evening in 1882, but it is much more interesting with the hindsight of history. Sitting at the Seder in Jerusalem, the young Prince George, the younger son of the king, did not know that his elder brother would pass away and that he would be the future George V. He certainly did not know that in 1917 his reign would extend over this city, Jerusalem. And he certainly did not know that one of the prominent streets in Jerusalem to this day King George Street would be named after him, and that it would be ultimately a major thoroughfare in a Jewish capital, in a Jewish state. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik once quoted Rabbi Mendel of Kotsk, reflecting on the symbolism of what ultimately became one of the symbolic foods of the Seder plate, the egg, commenting about the egg that, quote, aside from its dietary use, the egg is a higher component. In it lies a future life. It is the mysterious source of a future creation, end quote. The egg, one might say, embodies the connection to the past, but also serves as an exquisite embodiment of the link between generations, not only past and present, but also future. It embodies the Jewish belief in wondrous events yet to come. It is with this in mind that we can ponder the years of 1881 and 82 and think of the small achievements beginning in the land then and in the city then, how those achievements connect with what is yet to come. Lebrecht joins the efforts of Eliezer Perlman, Eliezer Ben Yehuda, to what happens in 1917 when the forces of George V enter Jerusalem. Lebrecht writes of Perlman, of Eliezer Ben Yehuda, as follows, quote, he reads 40,000 books and copies 500,000 citations. Day by day, Hebrew revives. Newspapers appear, followed by novels and recipe books. Tin foods carry Hebrew labels. Math is taught in Isaiah's tongue. When General Edmund Allenby liberates Jerusalem from the Turks in December 1917, his inaugural proclamation is printed in Hebrew, followed by Arabic, Russian, and Greek, end quote. The years 1881 and 1882 embody one small period in time. The Seder of 1882, one small moment in time. So much will occur between 1882 and 1917. But in the moment, in the Jerusalem Passover of 1882, the connections to past and future can be seen, a reminder of all that was and all that is yet to come. This is Meir Soloveitchik. Looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.